फर्स्ट परफेक्ट। सो हेलो, वेलकम एंड हैप्पी ग्रीटिंग्स टू ऑल ऑफ यू। गुड मॉर्निंग, गुड आफ्टरनून, वेर एवर यू आर। वेलकम टू द सेमिनार सीरीज ऑन एस्ट्रो स्टेटिस्टिक्स एंड एस्ट्रो इन्फॉर्मेटिक्स। दिस सीरीज इज स्पॉन्सर्ड बाय द इंटरनेशनल एस्ट्रो स्टेटिस्टिक्स एसोसिएशन एंड द IAU, एस्ट्रो इन्फॉर्मेटिक्स एंड एस्ट्रो स्टेटिस्टिक्स कमीशन। आई एम आशना त्रिपाठी, PhD स्टूडेंट फ्रॉम TLS टाउटनबर्ग, जर्मनी। सो लेट मी इंट्रोड्यूस टूडे स्पीकर, डोमिनिक बाउमैन। डोमिनिक कंप्लीटेड हिज PhD इन एस्ट्रोनॉमी इन 2016 एट द यूनिवर्सिटी ऑफ लंकाशेर इन द UK अंडर द सुपरविजन ऑफ प्रोफेसर डोनाल्ड कुड्स। आफ्टर दैट ही मूव टू KU लिवन इन बेल्जियम एज अ पोस्ट डॉक्टरल रिसर्चर इन द टीम ऑफ प्रोफेसर कॉनी एड्स एंड लेटर वॉज अवॉर्डेड एज अ इंडिपेंडेंट FWO रिसर्च फेलोशिप। सिंस सेप्टेम्बर 2023 डोमिनिक होल्ड्स अ लीडरशिप फैकल्टी पोजिशन एट न्यू कैसल यूनिवर्सिटी एंड ऑल्सो PI ऑफ अ रॉयल सोसाइटी यूनिवर्सिटी रिसर्च फेलोशिप एंड द ERC स्टार्टिंग ग्रांट प्रोजेक्ट कॉल्ड सिम्फनी ऑन मासिव स्टार एस्ट्रोसाइस्मोलॉजी। Today he will be talking about pulsating massive stars as a finely tuned instruments in the stellar symphony. If you want to ask questions or make a comment, please raise your hand or write in a chat so that you want to ask a question or comment, and I will unmute you at the end of the talk. If you have a very urgent question and cannot wait till the end of the talk, write the question in the chat and I will ask the speaker if the question is really urgent. Thank you, and over to you, Dominic.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation to you, Ashana, and everyone. And I'm going to steal that idea of you getting to ask the seminar speaker if the question is actually urgent or not. So let me go ahead and share my slides. Hopefully that works for everyone, and everyone can hear me well. So indeed, I'm going to talk to you all today. Thank you for your time on the interesting, at least in my opinion, topic of pulsations. And pulsations, in particular, of massive stars, and why I think they are instruments in the Stellar Symphony, because they can be used to pick out the particular structure of the stars, what the stars are made of, how big they are, how old they are in the cosmos. So here's a little bit of an overview of what I'll talk about. I've tried to group these into four different sections, and I appreciate that the audience might be quite diverse in terms of background and expertise. So if parts of the talk are more interesting to you and you're watching online later, then I have no problems with you skipping ahead or behind. So just to remind those who don't directly work on stars come in lots of different colors and sizes and brightnesses. So this is a Hubble Space Telescope image of Omega Sen. It's a globular cluster. And the image here is being manipulated so that all of the blue stars are moving to the left, and all of the red stars are moving to the right. So it's completely artificial. And then in a second step, we're moving all the bright stars to the top of the image, and we're moving all of the fainter stars to the bottom of the image. And this creates one of the most fundamental diagnostic diagrams in astronomy, which is known as the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, or its observational counterpart known as the color magnitude diagram. And this is very powerful because you can take a population of stars like this cluster Omega Sen, and you can do stellar structure and evolutionary science in real time. Most stars, as you can see, fall on this main sequence, as we call it. It's just this diagonal line from top left to bottom right. And then you've got some big red giant stars over here, which we call red giants. And then you've got some big blue stars over here, which we call horizontal branch stars, or blue giants, if you will. And then you've got the faint hot stars in the bottom left, which are difficult to see, and that's by design. These are the white dwarfs. So for a population of stars, by just looking at the color and the brightness of the stars, I can already say something about their evolutionary stage. But this is one of the schematic overviews of stellar evolution using the color magnitude diagram. And over time, looking at different clusters and different populations of stars, we've built up this cartoon of stellar evolution shown on the right. So stellar evolution is predominantly set by the mass of the star. And if you are born as a star with more mass, then your evolution is a little bit more exotic. And you, for example, explode as a supernovae, forming a black hole and a neutron star. If you're a lower mass star, a star like the Sun, for example, you have a little bit of a more boring life, in my opinion, and you live much longer because the main sequence lifetime of the Sun, defined by whether it's burning hydrogen in its core, is about 10 billion years. And at the end of that, the star will undergo an energy crisis and become a red giant and eventually a white dwarf. But this cartoon of stellar evolution on the right is missing some key ingredients of physics. So this assumes that all stars are perfectly spherical, they are not losing mass, they are not born with a companion such as a binary companion, they are not magnetic, they don't rotate, and they don't pulsate. And if you know anything about physics in general, if you start rotating a fluid that's full of charged particles, you will create a magnetic field, and you can have instabilities within the star, which is another word for pulsations. And here are a few artist's impressions of the physical conditions of some stars in the universe. Stars that are born with a close companion such that they touch, stars that lose large amounts of mass in explosive events, and stars that rotate so fast that they are no longer spherical and they actually form a disk around the star, where material is traveling at nearly the escape velocity of the system and is being lost into the interstellar medium. So that brings us to the physics that I am particularly interested in using seismology and pulsations to constrain, and that is in particular the rotation and the mixing inside a star. So here on the right is a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. So this is the luminosity on the y-axis and the temperature going from cool on the right to hot on the left. And here are two different massive stars. They're born at the so-called zero-age main sequence, and then they evolve to become a little bit more luminous and a little bit cooler towards the terminal age main sequence. And they do that for roughly 10 million years. But after that point, when there's no more hydrogen, the star's undergone its energy crisis, it has to do one of several things. And at this point in the star's evolution, when it crosses the Hertzsprung gap and goes over to the red supergiant domain in the cool, luminous part of the HR diagram, you can see that for slightly different mixing values, which are shown here as the solid and the dashed lines, you can get lots of different pathways. The so-called blue loop, where stars return towards the blue once again for a short infinitesimally amount of time, potentially, before returning to the red supergiant regime once again. So stellar evolution in the post-main sequence is particularly unconstrained. We don't have very good values of what this mixing or overshooting value is, and this is specifically referring to the mechanical mixing of convection as an instability at the boundary of the hydrogen burning core. Just a little bit more of efficiency in that mixing has drastic consequences for the post-main sequence evolution. Now, we can tackle with this using evolutionary tracks, as shown in the right. We can tackle this with pulsations, which is the topic of this talk, but we can also tackle this using hydrodynamical simulations, which I'm not an expert in, but in terms of big data and the experts here at Newcastle, this is really a field of expertise that we excel in, where we can calculate spherical, rotating, magnetic simulations of what stellar interiors really look like and compare them directly to the observations. So onto astroseismology, and this is really the types of pulsations and the types of pulsators. Here is another HR diagram with luminosity on the y-axis and temperature inverted on the x-axis. But now each ellipse that's hatched is denoting a different type of pulsating star. You'll be familiar, hopefully, with the first kind, which are called solar-like, and these are stars that are like the Sun in the sense that they have a turbulent outer convection envelope, and this is sufficiently turbulent to excite and damp the natural eigenfrequencies of the star. And those eigenfrequencies are the pulsation frequencies. For more evolved counterparts, the red giants and the semi-regular variables and the mirror variables, I'm not expecting you to learn all of these names, but traditionally the first pulsating star to show the general properties of the type is attributed the name. So solar-like and then Delta Scuti and Gamma Dor are stars in the night sky which have different types of variability. But I'm particularly interested in massive stars, those that explode as supernovae and form neutron stars and black holes at the end of evolution, and they sit above, roughly speaking, about six, seven, eight solar masses at birth, and so they're in this sort of region that I'm denoting with my mouse here. Now, that's the type of pulsators, and you can see that stars, as they pass through the HR diagram on these evolutionary tracks in solid black lines, they pretty much all stars will encounter one of these ellipses at some point in their life. So pulsations are ubiquitous in the universe at some point in a star's evolution. The two main types of pulsations that a star can have are the gravity modes. So these are restored by buoyancy. So this is not gravitational modes or gravitational waves of the space-time continuum. These are just buoyancy waves, and they are the same as if you take a cork below water, the buoyancy of the cork will want to oscillate the cork until it reaches its natural equilibrium position. And pressure modes are sound waves, and these are restored by the pressure gradient within the star. Now, there are often other types of modes, but I'm not going to go into detail on those today. These are the two main that I'll discuss. But first, what are oscillation modes? Well, for those of you who play musical instruments, you will be an expert in this already. So if you take a violin or a piano or a harp, you can represent the oscillations on a string very simply with describing the nodes and the antinodes. And the more nodes, the positions of node displacement, generally the higher the frequency of the oscillation. And this is why double basses play bass in the orchestra, and the piccolos and the violas play the high frequency soprano notes. So when you pluck the violin string, in fact, it's not just one mode of oscillation that is excited, you can have many. You have a variety of frequencies that are excited. But stars are clearly not one-dimensional, but you can imagine them as spherically symmetric for the purpose of identifying their pulsation modes. So here are four different animations of what these pulsation modes look like in 3D. And we describe these using spherical harmonics because stars are pretty much spheres. So the simplest mode of oscillation is the radial mode, which is just shown here by the star slightly contracting and cooling, and slightly expanding and heating, for example, periodically. And below that, I'm showing you what the spectral line of a star would do in response to that pulsation. So if there's anyone who works on quantitative spectroscopy of stars, you might be familiar with seeing some of your spectral lines start to wiggle and be perturbed. Well, this is the pulsations. And so there are more complicated configurations of pulsations. So as I describe my pulsations in spherical harmonics, I need three quantum numbers. The radial order, well, that's the number of radial nodes from the center to the surface of the star that we saw on the previous slide. The second one is the angular degree, the number of nodal lines on the surface, and the azimuthal order m, which is the number of those surface nodes that pass through the equator. So you can see with more complicated and larger values of l and m, you can get these quite pretty patterns in red and blue, and astroseismology exploits the fact that each individual unique combination of l, n, and m has an individual frequency. So if you can identify the frequency of oscillation, which I'll come to in a moment, you can identify the spherical harmonic geometry. Because that is unique, you can forward model that that observable and learn about the structure, because those pulsation modes are eigenmodes, and those eigenmodes are unique to the structure of the star. So how do we do this in practice? Well, we're looking at integrated surface quantities. So I mentioned spectral lines, but the simplest way of doing this that has become more popular in recent years because of the search for exoplanets is to look at the light emitted by a star as a function of time. And we call this a light curve. So predominantly the light curve of a star is probing the change in temperature. And so as a star gets brighter, as it goes upwards in this diagram and then fainter, the star is getting hotter and cooler, hotter and cooler. So if we can measure the brightness variations with extremely good precision, as was done with the Kepler space mission, which was mainly an exoplanet hunting mission, and just for comparison, I'm showing you what a typical small ground-based telescope precision can do, which is the WASP survey, and this is in red, and you can see that we've got great agreement here, but the error bars are obviously a little bit larger. Reality about 1,000 times larger from the ground. So we can get about one part per million precision from space telescopes, which has really revolutionized astroseismology, because with better light curves, we have better noise properties, and light curves from space telescopes have lots of data points, and so we're really in the regime of large data sets, which is really fantastic for our analyses. In recent years, since Kepler has been retired, we're using data from the TESS mission, and this is an artist's impression and animation of the TESS telescope. And this is a more survey-like telescope in which we're not only looking for exoplanets and binary stars, trying to find Eta Earth. But we're also trying to find lots of different varieties of objects in the universe. So TESS achieves this by having four cameras, which are large fields of view, about 24 square degrees, and it has four of them stacked together, and it covers a strip across the sky. And it observes all of the stars within that strip on the sky over 90 degrees for about 30 days. And then the telescope will rotate, and it will do that 13 times in a year. So over the course of a year, there will be 13 observational sectors, and then the instrument will flip over and it will repeat that. So over the course of 2 years, we're able to cover pretty much the entirety of the sky. Shown here in yellow is the nominal Kepler field, which stared at the same patch of sky for 4 years. And then after one of the momentum wheel breaks, it had to point in what we call the ecliptic. And the blue regions are the TESS sectors. So really, these two missions are highly complementary. But some of you may have noticed, and it's now highlighted in red, that there is a part of the sky in the north and the south, which we call the ecliptic poles, which have continual observations over the course of 1 year. So these are really, really long light curves with lots of data points with high photometric precision for studying pulsating stars or any type of object that happens to fall inside that field. So here's an example of one of our typical Kepler light curves. This is 4 years worth of data. And this is not noise. This is a light curve where each error bar is smaller than the dot. And so this is the pulsations of the star causing it to go up and down in a very short amount of time. And what brings us to the this brings us to the first type of analysis technique, which is kind of bread and butter within the field of astroseismology, and this is frequency analysis. So frequency analysis is effectively a Lomsdagger periodogram, a discrete Fourier transform for non-uniformly sampled data, or quote, the Fourier transform. And so you can see really why astroseismology benefits from long duration light curves, because if I take the Fourier transform of just 90 days, I have a very broad peak. This is just the Rayleigh resolution criteria. And if I take the last 1 year of this data, I have a narrow peak. I have more confidence. I have more precision on what the frequency of that oscillation is. But in fact, if I take the full 4 year light curve, I actually find out that there's two pulsation frequencies quite close together, which is giving rise to this beating phenomenon you can hopefully see in the light curve. So this is why astroseismology has really come into its own in the last decade, because we needed, roughly speaking, several years of data to really measure with high precision these pulsation frequencies. Now, I'm going back to our pressure and gravity modes. I'll give you an example of a real star. This is a pulsating star that's about two solar masses. And this is the Fourier transform of its light curve in the top panel. And you'll hopefully see that there are some nice peaks at low frequency. And we've got some nice peaks at high frequency. And these are the G modes and the P modes, the gravity modes and the pressure modes. So remember, pressure modes are restored by the pressure gradient. These are just sound waves. They tend to have higher frequencies. They probe the near surface layers of a star. And gravity modes, they are the buoyancy restored waves, and they tend to have lower frequencies, and therefore they predominantly probe the deep interior. On the bottom left and the bottom right, I'm just showing you the typical ray tracing diagram of a single G mode, and this is its propagation path. So it will bounce at some point off the. This is for the sun, so this has a convective envelope at roughly where my mouse is, and it will bounce off that convective envelope. And it will propagate into the center of the star and then bounce again over here, propagate in, bounce, and it's a lovely rosette diagram. On the right, this is a few different pressure modes. This is the ray tracing. So you have some high L modes, some high angular degree modes that bounce like they're skimming a stone off the surface, around the center, the surface of the star. And then you've got those radial modes where they don't have any angular dependence whatsoever, and so they just propagate from center to surface, or the full diameter of the star. Now, when we have the Fourier transform of one of these light curves, we can see there are patterns in the pulsation modes. And hopefully, you've stared at this for long enough now that you can see some of them too. So, in red, I'm showing a zoom in of the G modes in this bottom left panel. And you can see that they appear as pairs that are equally split. Well, this one's a little bit low. In fact, there is a third frequency in the middle that's quite low amplitude. It's a bit difficult to see on this scale. And on the right, I'm showing the same, the so-called triplet, but also a quintuplet, where there are three and five frequencies equally spaced, respectively. Now, pulsation modes being spherical harmonics have to obey the same quantum selection rules that solving the hydrogen atom does. So you cannot have an M value that is larger than L. The absolute value of M cannot exceed L. So when a star is rotating, the rotation lifts the degeneracy of the pulsation modes, and there is a Doppler boost to pulsation modes that are traveling in the direction of rotation. They get a little bit of a Doppler boost, and then the pulsations that are traveling against the direction of rotation will get a bit of a Doppler drag. So they get to higher and lower frequencies, respectively. So this is the same phenomenon as an ambulance passing you on the street. It sounds higher frequency as it's traveling towards you, and it sounds lower frequency as it's moving away from you. So already we've not done any modeling, but we can measure the rotation frequency of the star based on the splitting of these pulsation modes. Because the faster the rotation, the larger the splitting would be from that Doppler shift. So we do this in practice by looking at Fourier transforms. We look for these patterns, these multiplets. And so here is a quintuplet. I'm just showing you here in blue and black what the Fourier transform would look like from 1 year worth of data and 4 years worth of data, just to emphasize again that we get much better precision when we have longer light curves. And we can do this for relatively slow rotators with no model dependence whatsoever. And we do this by, as I said, looking at the splitting of how frequencies are perturbed to higher and lower frequency because of the rotation. So the faster the rotation, the larger the frequency splitting. There is a second method which applies to gravity modes. So these are the buoyancy-driven modes, and it's called the period spacing pattern. The period spacing pattern is the period differences between consecutive radial order pulsation modes. And so when we plot delta p as a function of p for a non-rotating and chemically homogeneous star, we should expect something that looks pretty much like a flat horizontal line. Now, as a star evolves, so I've color-coded three points in its evolution here in the HR diagram. We've got blue for A, green for B, and red for C. The period spacing pattern changes, and it does this for two reasons. One is because rotation will change, and rotation changes the gradient in the period spacing pattern, but I'll come back to that in the next slide. But the more important effect, I would say, is that because the structure of the star is changing, it's getting more luminous but cooler. The interior structure is having to adjust so that the star is always an object that's in balance. And so the pulsation periods, the pulsations of the star, will feel that change in physical structure. And what happens is it gives rise to a much more sawtooth-like pattern for stars that are older. Now, this is caused by a phenomenon known as mode trapping, which I don't really have time to go into details for. But effectively, you can see that for older stars, as they evolve up to the top right of the diagram here, you get this up-down sawtooth-like pattern. So now, not only can we look at the rotation of the star, we can also look at the age, or by proxy, how chemically unhomogeneous the star is. Just to show you that we have a high-dimensional big data problem in forward seismic modeling, this is a single mass and a single age. And I've calculated, this is theoretical models, I've calculated the period spacing patterns for different physical parameters that I need to put in my seven-dimensional grid of stellar evolution models. So on the left panel, I have the amount of mixing in the envelope, which is just increasing by an order of magnitude. And on the right, I've got the amount of mixing, that overshooting, the mixing specifically at the boundary of the convective core and the radiative envelope, and it's going up by a small amount. Also, I've got the rotation of the star in three different colors. So I've got green for non-rotating, then blue at 10% of the breakup velocity, and then red at 20%. Now imagine that I populate this diagram for lots of different masses and lots of different ages. You can see that this is a highly degenerate problem because there are lots of points in this diagram. And so we need a sophisticated statistical framework to identify the individual best fit parameters. You can't do this with a chi-squared. So this is highly degenerate. So in the last decade, we've also moved beyond more simple chi-squared fitting as a forward exercise to more sophisticated methods. So I'll just recap here that we're looking at high mass stars, in particularly in the Symphony project, and that roughly covers things that are in this green box here. but it can be to higher masses as well. And these are the supernova progenitors. There are three main types of variability. There are the stochastic stars, which, if I've got time to, about, I'll talk about at the end of the talk. And then there are the Beta Cephei stars and the slowly pulsating B stars, which have these coherent pressure and gravity modes that probe the physical conditions of the deep interior. So let's have a look at what we've learned. So as mentioned, this is a highly degenerate problem. If you want to look at the what I call the seminal papers of forward seismic modeling of massive stars, they're by Esan Monavecchi, and you could look at the dates here. This is really recent, so astroseismology of massive stars is quite a new field, I would say. And so in the HR diagram, or the Keel diagram here, because we're using log G instead of luminosity on the y-axis, each circle is a different model, a theoretical model for the structure of the star, and it has been color-coded by the best fit parameters, the best fitting pulsation solution for the observed pulsations that we see in the light curve. So for darker colors here, you've got better fit. But this was done back in 2015 with chi-squared, and you can see that there are lots of minima, there are lots of stripes, and this is highly degenerate. So to try and fix that problem, we put the spectroscopic constraints of the star, the 1, 2, and 3 sigma error box for what the temperature and the log G of the star is, independently from looking at the spectral lines. But within this grid, there are three parameters. Of course, there's the mass and the age of the star, which defines the general trend from bottom left to top right. But we've also got things like the metallicity of the star. We've also got how much mixing was in the envelope. And here's a schematic diagram for what that actually means in practice. So it's unitless on the y-axis, but the grey region is the convective core. This is incredibly turbulent, and it's effectively instantaneously mixed, and it's chemically homogeneous. And then you've got the envelope of the star, which is radiation dominated, so there's no convection instability, and that is in green. But we need to stitch these two regions together, and that therefore introduces a free parameter, which is this overshooting value. So where those stitch points occur, specifically here and here, and the gradient of that zone is the free parameter overshooting. And that's what gives rise to the fan-like spread of the models that previously we've seen evolutionary tracks that were single lines, but it's actually the mixing that changes them to have a divergent-like nature. So if you want to have a look at a little bit more detail of how we've constrained specifically the overshooting, there's a few papers on the references on the screen that are a little bit more recent that does this a bit more sophisticatedly than the Moravegi papers. So we can go one step further. So in 2021, Mai Pedersen published a paper where we looked at eight different model grids. And we did a model selection problem where we modeled one star eight different times with these different physical setups. And then we looked at the Bayesian information criterion, for example, to penalize for the complexity of the model, but also look at the goodness of fit. And therefore, we can say which of the eight, which represent different physical conditions, best fit the star. The short answer, spoiler alert, is that different stars prefer different model prescriptions. That's satisfying in one way because it shows that our models are incomplete and there is still work to be done on putting prescriptions, because these prescriptions for mixing are based on one-dimensional, non-rotating, non-magnetic evolutionary models. So there's a lot of assumptions in there that need to be improved. But it's also, I suppose, unsatisfying that there is no one size fits all to understanding rotation and mixing inside massive stars. But that keeps us employed, so that's probably not too bad of a thing. So here's a comparison led by a former PhD student, Matthias Mikkelsen, at KU Leuven, where we looked at the direct comparison of chi-squared fitting versus an improved Merit function, which is the Mallard-Hinobis distance. And this is much better, much, much better than chi squared for such a highly degenerate problem, because the Mallard-Hinobis distance allows you to penalize for these degeneracies and correlations and include the so-called theoretical uncertainties. For example, the location of a star in the HR diagram, its luminosity and its temperature are not independent parameters. They are related by what's known as the Stefan-Boltzmann law. So if you include this knowledge, you include these correlations, you get a much more well-controlled posterior, and you can actually improve the precision on which and accuracy on which we can provide parameters to the wider community from astroseismology. So if you're interested in that, please have a look at Matthias's papers. I want to spend a minute or two talking about one of my favorite stars. This now was a star that was observed by TESS. It's relatively close, so it's only about 600 parsecs away, confirmed by the Gaia mission. It ha was observed by TESS in its continuous viewing zone. So we have a pristine light curve. Here is a segment of it in the top right, but the total light curve lasts about a year. And remember, the longer the light curve, the narrower the peaks are, and the higher the precision we can get on the pulsation frequencies. So this is the Fourier transform of that light curve, and you can see there are some lovely pulsation peaks. Pretty much every peak in here is a pulsation mode. So we have a large data problem in the sense that we have to extract the significance of these and actually forward model them as well. So I'll skip over the observational analysis, but the details are in several of my papers and Siemens' paper from 2023. But again, we applied this Mellon-Obis distance forward modeling scenario to this massive star, and you can see in the table on the left here the typical 2 sigma confidence intervals that we get for such a star. So the age is roughly 25%, the mass is roughly 15%. In terms of relative error. And these are unprecedentedly high levels of precision, whereas before TESS and before this move to the Mellon-Obis distance in forward modeling, the typical accuracy would be roughly 50 to 100% relative precision. And yes, I do mean 100%, is that we have some parameters will have zero ability to be constrained. What was interesting about this star is that not only could we get really high precision on things like the convective core mass. And why is that important? Well, that is which we got here from Monte Carlo sampling of the full posterior space. We can actually provide the number of helium atoms or the amount of helium in kilograms to our colleagues who work on supernovae. This is a really important parameter, the convective core mass, because the amount of helium and then later iron is what drives the supernova explosion. And leaves you with the neutron star or the black hole. So really, these massive stars, despite we have this schematic overview of their evolution, we do need to have the details because the details matter for chemical enrichment of the galaxy, because the supernova is what expels those metals across the universe, for the next generation of stars. The second thing that was really interesting about this star is that we're able to constrain its interior rotation profile. So remember, we have these multiplets, and if I have many of those multiplets, I can map out the rotation as a function of radius. So the faster the rotation, the larger the splitting in those multiplets. And so we did that, and we found that the core of the star was rotating only about 1.5 times faster than its envelope. Now, there are some assumptions and simplifications in this model, but it turned out, well, there's three, in fact, but the yellow turned out to be the best fitting model. And this actually is a very small amount, but it is significantly it's far enough away from unity. So what does this mean? It means that the star is not a rigid body rotator, but it also means that the star is not rapidly rotating in its core relative to its envelope. Now, for current expectations, stars should be rotating roughly 100 times faster in their cores than their envelopes. And the reason for this is the angular momentum transport of the star is supposedly inefficient, such that when the star evolves and its radius expands, the outer envelope should slow down and the inner core will contract, and that would speed up. So if a star is rotating, it's the same as the ice skater on the ice. When they bring their arms out or bring their arms in, they're going to slow down or speed up. So stars should behave similarly, we thought. But it turns out that since this star is quite close to being nearly a rigid rotator, there is a very efficient angular momentum transport mechanism that is completely missing from our models. And the leading contenders for this are waves themselves, the pulsations carry the angular momentum, but also magnetic fields, which are currently lacking entirely from our models. So I just wanted to finish this part of the talk by showing you the landscape of the interior rotation that we've been able to achieve in astroseismology. So on the left is the low mass stars, and each circle represents the interior rotation measurement of a star for different evolutionary stages shown in different colors. So you can see here stars tend to evolve from being so-called dwarfs, these are the main sequence stars, to the red giants in the bottom right. In the middle panel, these are also the low mass stars, but there are also triangles. And this is a figure that's woefully out of date now, even though it's only a couple of years old, because astroseismology is always measuring new rotation rates. The triangles represent stars, the same stars that have envelope rotation rates from astroseismology. And if they are significantly differential, they're connected by a dashed line. And you can see there's a lot of young stars in green that are rigid rotators. And as stars evolve, they start to become a little bit more differential. So they're roughly one order of magnitude faster rotating in their cores. And then as stars evolve a little bit further, as the red giants and then the secondary clump stars and the red clump stars, their differentiality decreases. Now, in the right-hand panel, again, this is out of date because there are other stars that have been added to this panel since. But one of the goals of the Symphony Project is to fill this diagram because this diagram is specifically for the massive stars, of which we now have roughly 100. But at this point, we only had about seven or eight in this diagram. And these massive stars are important, as I've mentioned, for chemical enrichment of the galaxy through their supernova explosions. And you can also see that they're all young stars, they're all main sequence. We don't have any evolved stars in this diagram. That statement is still true to this day. And there is no clear consensus because we've got differential stars with about an order of magnitude, and we've got rigid rotators. So there's no clear pattern here. There needs to be a lot more work to understand this. So in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I'll talk about one of the topics that's close to my heart. So up until this point, I've been talking about astroseismology from coherent, so perfectly periodic pulsations. In the last part of the talk, I'm co going to talk about stochastic pulsations. So whereas the coherent pulsations are driven by a coherent process, such as a heat engine, a Carnot cycle, so to speak, operating in the outer layers of the star. Now we're going to look about turbulence exciting waves and those waves and their observables. So as I mentioned earlier, we have very sophisticated hydrodynamical simulations that rotate or don't with magnetic fields or don't. We have lots of different setups. And here's just a video from the paper from Edelman in 2019, a postdoc, former postdoc from Newcastle. And this is the interior of the star, it's convection, burning hydrogen. And the outside of the star, we've cut into it, so you're sort of seeing a wedge down into the very center, but this is a full 3D sphere. These are colors are the temperature fluctuations caused by gravity waves. Now, at the boundary of the convective core, which is roughly where my mouse is, you have an instability, convection doesn't suddenly turn off and radiation takes over as the energy transport mechanism. There is an instability that's created, and that instability can then lead to degeneration of stochastic waves. So the picture as we have it today is this convective core, which is ubiquitous across the main sequence in the in the massive stars. So therefore, waves generated by this instability should also be ubiquitous. The debate currently in the literature, which I'll come to at the end of my talk, is whether these waves actually make it to the surface. Some of the hydrodynamical simulations seem to suggest they do, and some of them don't. But generally speaking, the stochastic signal of waves is this low-frequency power excess or the stochastic low-frequency variability phenomenon that we have since started calling it. So what does that look like? So on the left here, I'm just showing you another setup. This is from a completely independent group. So I'm hopefully not too biased here. This is from the group of Falk Herwig in Victoria, Canada. And they're showing here an equatorial slice through a 3D simulation. This is not rotating simulation, but it's a bit higher resolution, as you can see. You've got turbulent convection in the core. And then at that core boundary, oh, that was convenient that it stopped there. You can see the sharp decline in the convective velocities. But out here, you've got these ripples, you've got these rings, and these are the stochastic gravity waves that are excited. Now, in the literature, there has been a built-up consensus that these waves exist. These waves contribute to the mixing and the angular momentum inside a star. But the debate is whether the phenomenon of the observables that we see at the surface of a star is originating from the waves that are generated from the core, or are they waves generated from further out? Or maybe they're a second generation of waves that interact. So there's a highly nonlinear chaos problem here, which I've color-coded the references here with different suggestions. So here is what the frequency spectrum of the waves in black and orange look like inside the radiative envelope of this simulation. And here is what the observed frequency spectrum of the surface of a star that is very similar in parameters to the setup of the hydrodynamical simulation. So, being a junior postdoc back in the day, I had seen this phenomenon before. It looks like granulation in the sun. And so, granulation in the sun is historically fit by a Harvey profile, which is basically a Lorentzian with an exponent that's a free parameter, this gamma here. And so, we set out to fit the stochastic low frequency variability signal for as many massive stars as we can to see if we learned anything about it and ultimately compare to the simulations. Now, we did that back in 2020, for this is roughly, I think it's about 30 massive stars. You can see the evolutionary tracks in the HR diagram here. And I've color-coded the circles based on the characteristic frequency, this nu car, which is nu c down here in the Lorentz formula. And you can see, hopefully, that even though it's small number statistics, there is a purplish gradient near the ZAMs, the zero-age mean sequence, and the stars sort of get yellowish as they evolve. So what we seem to be seeing here is that the dominant frequencies are getting lower as the star evolves, and this actually makes sense because the star is getting larger as it evolves. So the waves need to travel a larger distance from the center of the star to the surface. And so the factor of two roughly here, or a few, is about the same as the factor of two or a few that a star's radius would change. So we think here qualitatively in 2020, we think we're seeing stellar evolution in real time here. However, since then, we've expanded our methodologies because you might be thinking, why are they fitting Lorentzians to a Fourier transform? That's not very sophisticated, and I agree. So a couple of years later, we moved to a Gaussian process regression fitting process, a procedure, and where we fit the light curve directly. And this is using a kernel where we had an ensemble of damped simple harmonic oscillators. Because if waves are excited stochastically, they are not standing modes, they are traveling waves, and so they are damped simple harmonic oscillators. And just for sake of sanity, you can see here that generally speaking, there is a good agreement in frequency space between the blue and the green fit, where the green is the Lorentzian and blue is the Gaussian process. Well, it's the Fourier transform of the Gaussian process regression model, because of course that is fit in the time domain. But the Gaussian process regression procedure has extra variability, extra flexibility in the sense that we can look at other parameters, such as the quality factor, so how stochastic, how periodic the time series is, and that also seems to evolve. So stars start out being very stochastic with low quality factors. And as they evolve, they start to get quasi-periodic. Their quality factors are of order unity or higher. So this has opened up a new methodology for looking at this stochastic low-frequency variability phenomenon. Now, one of the other postulated theories is that you can have waves and variability caused by not the convective core. These massive stars are not just convection in the core and radiation in the envelope. There are small so-called subsurface convection zones, although I don't personally think that's a very good name for them, because when you in this cartoon here, they're often labeled as convection, and the convection is very efficient and it causes waves in the radiation layer above and below. However, when you run hydrodynamical simulations, again, this is a completely independent setup from KU Leuven. So you've seen three sets of hydrodynamical simulations now. You can see that this subsurface convection zone actually is only carrying roughly, what's this, about of order 10% of the energy transport is by convection. So it's still of order 90% is being carried by radiation. Now, this means that the stochastic low frequency variability that we see at the surface, if it's not coming from the core, then it's clearly not coming from convection, it's coming from waves that are triggered by convection. So I guess we've just moved the problem somewhere else within the star. So waves are either excited at the core and reach the surface, or waves are excited at the near surface and reach the surface, or maybe both. I personally think the latter is true. There has been a historically a characterization of this instability near the surface by fitting spectral lines, and this has been attributed to a phenomenon that's called macro turbulence. So macro meaning large scale and anisotropic, but this has been historically just a fudge factor. We know that we need to fit spectral lines, so we have to introduce a non-rotational form of broadening. But we have not really, until very, very recently in the last few years, been able to quantify the physics of what that is. Now, recently we took this hypothesis that, well, is it the core, is it the surface, or is it both? And so we looked at low metallicity stars, so stars in the Large Magellanic Cloud and the Small Magellanic Cloud, where the metallicity is about half and one tenth of what it is in the Milky Way galaxy. And if you have lower metallicity, therefore it is much harder to have convection. So in this HR diagram here, the blue region is the region predicted to not have subsurface convection using the Rayleigh criterion, which is shown and defined in the blue box here. Now, the Rayleigh criterion is just a ratio of diffusion over the convective buoyancy, whereas traditionally people just use the Schwarzschild criterion for convection, which is just the temperature gradient of whether a star is convective or not in a particular region. And as you can see, the red crosses, we've got some stars that are inside this region, and we've got some stars that are outside of this region. And we looked at the variability for all of these stars to see if there was any difference in the variability inside and outside the region. And it turns out, I'm just showing you a few examples here, it turns out that there isn't much at all. So again, it's a small sample statistics. The details are in the paper. I don't have time to discuss it now, but we had to use a new sophisticated method of extracting the light curves. We used the Gaussian process regression to fit the light curves, and then we looked at the differences in the distributions between stars inside and outside. But hopefully you can see by eye that these look fairly similar. There might be a hint of it being slightly low amplitude, but this wasn't statistically significant. So that brings me to my conclusions. So astroseismology, the study of pulsations, has demonstrated that a lot of stars are close to being rigid rotators, but are not perfectly so. But we can also probe the mixing inside stars, both in terms of the boundary at the convective core, which sets how much helium and iron the star has for its as a supernova progenitor, but also the envelope mixing, which changes the path in the HR diagram. And if you put all of these uncertainties together, this means that we're currently underestimating stellar ages by roughly 25% or more. This is kind of scary for people who work on galactic evolution models, because if stars live at least 25% longer, then the enrichment of the host galaxy, there is a longer period that you can do that for. In the second half of the talk, I spoke about the stochastic variability of stars, and I showed how this also probes the masses and the ages of stars because of that transition in the HR diagram. And I'll just finish by mentioning that this is not the end of the story by any means. We have lots of missions and projects that are coming online or have just come online. Some of the logos, hopefully, you recognize. For example, the ESA Plato mission and the NASA Roman mission are very close to launch. We've got spectroscopic follow-up of low metallicity stars, and we've got future missions such as the CubeSpec mission led from KU Leuven and the Haydn mission led by University of Bologna to look at specifically astroseismology of massive stars, which so far has not been done other than a complementary science. And hopefully we can move beyond the main sequence and we can push to the post-main sequence where stars are supposedly not meant to be found, and yet we do find them inside this yellow box. So with that, I'll thank you for your attention and happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Dominic. It was really lovely. Thank you. Thanks a lot. And we are ready for our questions. So, any questions? Yeah, Lucy, you can go ahead.
Hi, hi everyone. Thanks for a great talk, Dominic, and also thank you for making a friendly time for me. So I'm Lucy. I'm in Kyoto University, and it's almost 6 p.m. So yeah, I'm glad about the time today. So I was wondering. Well, yeah. First of all, it's really exciting that we now have rotation rates of like five massive stars or so. So I was wondering with that slide. Yeah, with this sample, you mentioned that some of them are rigidly rotating, or you can say something about differential rotation. So I guess I was wondering with these, oh sorry, is it four stars? to read this book?
So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in this panel.
5. Okay, cool. So yeah, I was wondering, out of those 5 stars, like how many of them are you kind of sure about them being rigidly rotating? And also, do you know, did you also do analysis to estimate the magnetic fields? Or can you do that? Sorry, these are really basic questions,
No,
but
they're excellent
yeah.
questions. So I should really, I was a little lazy. I haven't updated this because this figure is just straight out of a review paper I wrote in 2023. So as mentioned, there's roughly another 100 stars that are in this mass range that have since been
Wow.
analyzed.
Okay.
And they probably sit, they confirm, I would say they confirm qualitatively the picture that I'm showing in this panel, such that there are some stars that are close to being rigid, and there are some that are differential by about an order of magnitude. So the picture seems quite qualitatively quite clear, I would say. Now the problem with these ensemble analyses, in my opinion, is that they have a lot of simplifying assumptions. So you can get bulk properties on saying things like, generally speaking, if I approximate the whole of the core and the whole of the envelope as one as two distinct zones, I can measure the differentiality between those two. That's fine, but there is a little bit of nuance there because different pulsation modes probe different depths within a star. So you're kind of by doing that ensemble approach, you're kind of averaging the whole of the radiation zone as a single zone, but there might then you're not going to see the differentiality within the zone, if you see what I mean. So with more multiplets, so in this star in particular, for example, we had, I think, four multiplets. So we could zone the star into four zones in principle, which gives you the nuance of, for example, the shape of the rotation in this inner part. So here's the core, here's the transition zone, and here's the bulk of the envelope. And the other thing that you can do when you look at a detailed individual star analysis is you can compare different assumptions, which you can't do in an ensemble analysis. Or people, I should say, people choose not to because they want to get their paper finished. Maybe that's the way to phrase this. So you can do this. You can look at different shapes of the rotation profile and then do model selection to say which one is better. And that's what we did here. We said that the yellow is a much, much better fit based on the BIC criterion. To your second question about magnetic fields, this is something that is very, very hot off the press. Earlier this year, so 2026, this star was studied by I'll butcher the names, I'm afraid, but Jelle van der Snicht is a PhD student from Leuven. But if you search for Vincent van Leer, this name here, I think he was second author on the paper. So they claim in their paper that they forward modeled this star. Now that we know the rotation, they were also able to look at the magnetic field inside this star because, like rotation, let me find a figure, like rotation, lifting the degeneracy of these different modes and splitting them, the magnetic field will also do that. So it is entirely possible, and as a proof of concept, this is a very powerful exercise. But however, there are high levels of model assumptions and uncertainties and simplifications that are being propagated forward. So I would take their values with a pinch of salt. But in principle, we can do magnetic fields inside stars. I didn't have time to talk about magnetic fields, but people can send me emails and I can send references if they're interested.
Cool, thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Nozan, you can go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, hello everybody, and thank you, Dominic. Thank you for the nice presentation. I finally know more about astroseismology. So I have a bunch of questions. I'm just going to ask them one at a time. So let me start with the first one. The name is pretty clear. Astroseismology is about. No. So the thing is that you talked about stars and the whole pulsations and the waves in the stars and everything. So my question is, I've also seen people talking about like alpha waves traveling through accretion disk and stuff. Is this the same topic? And do you yourself or your team at Newcastle University working with accretion disk and basically applying the same techniques in accretion disk and specifically in AGNs to the so-called corona, which is responsible for the X-ray generation. That is a hot blob of plasma. Because I know the geometry of corona is an active field of research. So are you aware of that? Is this something that we can actually apply to accretion disk and corona and similar perhaps topics?
That's an interesting question. So I'm not an expert outside of stars. I am aware of colleagues both in Newcastle and externally who work on the variability of accretion, for example, onto compact objects. And in principle, if you've got variability, you can do a time series analysis, and you can look for periodicity. And it does seem to be, for example, there's what's called, if I'm not going to get this wrong, quasi-periodic oscillations, QPOs, in accretion onto compact objects. There is also seismology of the rings of Saturn, for example, which is to do with tidal interactions. So there are lots of driving mechanisms that can create oscillations, but in principle, the limit of astroseismology will always be the applicability of spherical harmonics. So if your object is a sphere, then the method will be applied, and you will get an answer, right? If you have a disk, I'm not sure what spherical harmonic equivalent you would need to apply. That would be a highly perturbed system if you want to model it as a sphere. But in principle, the same methodologies can be applied.
Okay, thank you. Can I ask the second question or
Sure.
okay. So you talked about degeneracy problem. What is it exactly?
So the problem in layman's term is, if I find a pulsation period here, I don't know if it so it has a distinct period, and remember I said it's like there's a unique period for a unique combination of L, N, and M. So let's say a period of one day. Let's make the easy numbers easy. What I don't know from that is what the rotation is alone. So what I need to do is to extract a period spacing pattern, and then look for the morphology of the pattern to try and break the degeneracy. Because if I also have periods up here, and they are following the horizontal line in this green pattern, but if I have a period of seven and it's down here in the blue line, then I've been able to break the rotation degeneracy, right? So degeneracy in this term just means that different combinations of physical parameters can give rise to the same observable, even though the observable should be a unique quantity.
Right, thank you. And the last question is, in one of your plots, the power spectral density plots in the end, toward the end of your presentation, you have a frequency, I believe it's called characteristic frequency or something,
One of
with a
these,
dot,
maybe?
excuse me?
Is this the figure you, which figure?
And no, maybe a few slides after this one, perhaps. Yes, maybe this one.
Okay.
The dotted dashed line, either the green one and the is this does this have anything to do with the band frequency that people usually use that frequency to associate it with kind of properties of the system, like mass of the system, or depending on what the system is this the same thing here, or just what is it exactly, this frequency? Is there
So
anything
the
special about that frequency?
So yeah, this is exactly the nuance of the point. So the characteristic frequency in the green model is just this empirical, it's not a physically motivated model of the system, other than the fact that the sun has granulation, which seems to be well modeled by a Lorentzian. And if you take the Fourier transform of an exponential, you have a Lorentzian. So there is only an empirical justification for the green model. And so that's just reporting the best fitting characteristic frequency. Now, imagine your system is actually an ensemble of damped simple harmonic oscillators. A single Lorentzian would not be a very good fit to that, because if the system is near resonance, you'd get a power excess at the resonant frequency, which is why there is a little bit of a difference between the blue and the green. And the blue characteristic frequency is located next to the bump in the profile. This cannot be captured by the simple Lorentzian. The model is too simple. So there's a little bit of a discrepancy here, just because it's a different model. The GP model is a different function than the Lorentzian, because you're fitting the time domain with the damped simple harmonic oscillation kernel, and the green is a fit to the Fourier transform with the Lorentzian. Physically speaking, this is telling you what the characteristic variability frequency of the system is. But if it's an ensemble, then there can be a wide scale, a wide range of scales that the system is oscillating in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any other questions? If not, then I will again thank you, Dominic. Thank you for accepting our invitation and giving a very nice talk. And
My
hope to
pleasure. Thank
listen
you.
from you in future as well. Thank you. And see
Thank you
you
very
all
much.
in the next month seminar series.
Thank you, everyone. Nice to see you.